Hello, friends, and welcome to the Handyman Success Podcast. Our mission is to teach and inspire by sharing the stories and insights of our guests. Whether you're a prospective, new, or seasoned handyman business owner, you will learn practical business tips you can apply today and be inspired that you can reach your goals and create a better tomorrow. I'm one of your hosts, Jason Call, owner of Handyman Marketing Pros. We equip small, family-owned handyman businesses with modern websites and SEO to help grow their businesses online. I'm joined by my co-host, Alan Lee, who has built his handyman business to a point where it runs without him. He now teaches others, step-by-step, how to do the same thing through his Handyman Journey business coaching. You can learn more about our marketing and coaching services by scheduling a call with us on handymansuccess.net. So whether you're patching drywall, sitting in the office, or making your third run to Home Depot, we invite you to pull up a chair and sit with us on another episode of the Handyman Success Podcast. Today, we're joined by Ray Duke with the Bulletproof Handyman located in Tucson, Arizona. Ray, thank you so much for being with us, man. If you don't mind, give us a little lay of the land, a little snapshot of you, your business, and we'll just kind of go from there.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. So my business is a little different than a lot of handyman businesses. I serve exclusively property management companies. And when I say exclusively, I mean I do not do any business with any homeowners, with the only exception being if it's a favor to a property manager.
Very cool. How many property managers do you serve?
The number changes a little bit over time, but I have two really huge clients that are property management companies. And within each company, there are multiple managers. So they gain and lose managers at times. So the number of managers changes. But I have two huge clients, and then I have like a handful of smaller property management companies that I sometimes do work for when they have overflow or they'll send certain types of jobs my way. But the number goes up and down. I would say of my main clients, it's 5 to 8 property managers at any given point in time, and then a handful of the smaller ones.
Okay.
Awesome. Awesome. And Ray, how did you get your start? Like, what did you do before you did this? Now you're a YouTube rock star. Like, what did you do before Bulletproof Handyman, and what kind of got you into this line of work?
So, well, I grew up in West Texas in a family where all the men they were self-employed, whether plumbers or my stepdad was a cabinet maker, electricians, everybody had different things. But I kind of grew up doing the work. Most of my adult life, I've been in aviation as an avionics tech, which I do not have any affinity for at all. I don't like planes. I never did. It was just what paid the bills. And interestingly, I've actually had a couple failed handyman businesses in the past as well, when I wasn't taking things seriously the way that I am this time around. But yeah, most of my life has been aviation and then construction, aviation, back to construction. And this time around, I think one of the big changes was, I've had a family, but I had identical twins on the way right after I quit my job to start this business. Like, I quit my job, and within a few weeks, we found out we were pregnant, which we had planned. We just didn't think would happen so quickly. Then found out it was identical twins. So then that's when I realized I really had to kick things into high gear.
What? Wow. How long have you been in business?
Right now, so September will be 4 years. So like 3.5 years.
Okay. And you mentioned a couple failed handyman ventures prior. If you don't mind, how did they fail? What are you doing different this time where you've been successful? If you could kind of walk through the differences there.
Yeah. So when I've tried to be a handyman in the past, I think I approached it the way that I feel like most people approach it initially, which is I didn't want to be working my hourly job. So my solution was, well, I'll go be a handyman. And I didn't take the time to go learn anything about business. To me, I thought the business was the work, and that if I knew how to do the work and people paid me for it, it would be fine. So I didn't know what to charge. You know, I didn't have any affinity towards getting good at scheduling or getting efficient with my processes or keeping an inventory. And I was also single at those times, so I didn't need much, you know. So I just kind of went out, put some Craigslist ads out. I'd do it for maybe 3 to 6 months. And then if there wasn't enough money or, you know, a slow season came, it was always just so easy to just go back into aviation. Because if you're experienced in aviation, any city that has an airport, you've got a good job with benefits. So I would just kind of do it, you know, and I don't want to say in my spare time, but I would do it until it wasn't fun anymore. And then I would go back to aviation.
Okay. Wow. And so what, this go around, how did you go about like learning those business skills? Cause I know a lot of people, like you said, most people kind of just go into this handyman thing, just kind of expecting it to work out and they don't want to work their main job. Right. I think you nailed it right on the head. So what kind of advice would you have for people that are looking to take this thing serious, get more information about business? Like, do they need to go to a 4-year college? Like what would you say? How did you get your business?
I'd say everything you need to know is on the internet, including how to do the work. YouTube specifically, but not only YouTube, but it's all on the internet. And the only big difference between when I didn't succeed before, well, number one, I literally wasn't trying to succeed. I was just trying to pay my bills. And I think the big change this time was probably, I think when I stumbled into property management, I realized that there was an unserved niche there and that I could charge a premium because I could serve that niche that wasn't being served well. And that was the first step, I think, that made me go, okay, so there's things that I don't know that if I had known in the past. And I think that was the big thing, was I realized had I found property management in the past, my business would have gone a dramatically different direction. And then at the same time, realizing just that there's things I don't know. So if I don't go and literally just watch other handymen on YouTube or join handyman Facebook pages, and not even handyman, but, you know, another lesson, I had a food truck once. And the reason my food truck failed in hindsight, once I was done, was I realized I started out being special. You know, I had the amazing food and the really big fans. And I watched the hot dog carts and the cheap burger trucks get more business than me. And I was too stubborn to stop trying to be special and to start trying to go, okay, this is a business. And a purpose of a business is to generate revenue. So I need to stop worrying about what I think makes me special or what makes me cool and start thinking more about what do my clients want to spend their money on.
Wow. That's humility, man. That's amazing. Like that's,
yeah, really, it was really hard. It was honestly, yeah. It's why I shut the food truck down. And I loved that job. I think more than the handyman business, I really truly loved it, but I loved it because I was special, not because I was good at running a business. And had I let go of the being special part and focused on the running a business part, that likely would have worked.
Maybe the bulletproof food truck is the next chapter one day.
You know what? You never know. I have so many dreams and aspirations. I wish I could live 1,000 years so that I could just experience each different type of life and each type of business and each geography and each culture.
Wow.
That's awesome.
But you never know.
Let's get down to the property management, which I know, it's a huge thing that I know myself and Alan recommend as like a marketing channel, a revenue stream to develop relationships with property managers. So I've got a kind of a double headed question here is firstly, what in your journey led you to property managers? And then secondly, you mentioned that they were not being served well. And so my kind of follow-up question of not only what led you to property managers, but why, what's missing with how property managers mostly operate and how do you kind of fill that gap and are something different?
Yeah, I actually like telling the story. So it was very soon after I started this business. I feel like I got lucky. I was also putting in the effort for the opportunities. But I also got lucky. I just got a call one day from a property manager. I had never worked for one before in my life, didn't know anything about that industry at all. It was foreign to me. And so this girl calls and says, I found your ad on Craigslist and I have a job I need you to do. And I asked her what the job was. And she said it was a door to a bedroom where the screw just kept turning. The hinge was coming off because the screw kept turning. And I was really booked out already. I was actually doing well in terms of staying busy and I didn't really need her work. So at the time, my trip minimum was $50, which is such an absurd number to me right now. And I felt that that was hard. I had complaints about a $50 trip minimum from like average income homeowners who didn't feel that I earned the 50, but I didn't need the work. So I knew it was going to be a 5-minute job. And I said, well, you know, I've got an $80 trip fee, but I can do it if you want. And I only said that because I didn't need the work. And she didn't bat an eye. She's like, yeah, that sounds fine. Perfect. You know, and she sent me the job. And then she said, well, she didn't send the job yet. The next thing she said was, oh, I forgot to mention, I'm a property manager. Is that okay with you? And her tone had changed. And I was like, why would that not be okay with me? Work is work. And she said, have you worked for property managers? I said, no. And she said, well, when you work for us, you have to buy the materials with your own money. And then we may not pay you for up to 30 days. And then she caveated and, of course, said, you know, I'll try to pay you as fast as I can. But in property management, you have to put your own money in for materials and you have to wait to get paid. And I thought, it's a 5-minute job. If I can charge $80 for 5 minutes worth of work and not get paid till later, that's fine. And I did the job. She called me for another. It was another stupid, simple job. And I just suddenly had this click in my head where I go, wait a minute. I can afford to invest what little money I have into materials and wait for that money to get reimbursed a month later, but I can charge a lot more money than I'm charging. That sounds like if I'm willing to sort of keep rolling that over and essentially bottleneck myself for a few months, I should find myself in a position where I have materials money built up in the account from the extra labor that I get to charge. So I just started rolling everything back, every penny I made, just lived like we were poor for a few months and kept rolling that money back in until I had a nice piece of capital set aside for materials. And I really never looked back after that point. Oh, and then you asked about what's different in terms of them being an underserved niche. And the thing is, so if you're a regular homeowner, and you have a toilet that stops working, if you're a regular homeowner and you've got two toilets in your house, that's okay. You know, you can call, what do they call them? Like a chuck with a truck. You know, you can call sort of anybody, reliable or unreliable, who shows up on time or who doesn't. You can put up with some annoyance and eventually get that toilet fixed while using the other one. If you're a property manager who's managing, say, 450 properties, and the law requires that those toilets all work or else the tenant doesn't have to pay rent, you're now in a position where you can't afford just a regular handyman who may or may not be reliable. You can't afford that. Your whole day is going to be just full of phone calls from angry tenants and people missing appointments, tenants not wanting to pay rent because their toilet's been broke for the entire month. So I realized they didn't have anything that resembled a business serving them. And I shouldn't say they didn't have any. There are others out there who do exactly this, but it's dramatically underserved. So then I realized I can charge a premium. You know, the $80 trip fee, it turns out, was actually low. And I realized I can charge a premium if I can change their life, if I can turn their workday. You know, most of our lives are spent working rather than at home. So I can change her life by serving her so well, by serving the tenants so well, that she doesn't have to do anything for maintenance other than just send me a work order and forget about it. So that's what I started doing. I just started raising my prices to see where the ceilings were at. And my goal is to make sure that no property manager ever needs to talk to me or a tenant. Their life should be a tenant puts in a work order, they send it to me, and they move on with whatever other stuff they need to be doing. And a little while later, they receive an invoice. And that's what I've done. And I think that's why I've had some success with it.
Wow, that's gold. And how do you go? That was your very first property manager. And then how do you find them moving forward? Or did that one kind of refer up to you? Or what does that look like?
There's what I did. And then there's what I do/recommend. What I did at the time, out of curiosity, when I had the $80 trip fee, is I just said, okay, I wonder if I can do 100. So I wrote a very basic introduction letter, you know, just a few paragraphs saying, my name's Ray Duke. Here's what I do. You know, my trip fee's $100. If you have any work, I'd be happy to work for you. And I sent it out to a dozen property management companies, and I ended up getting like three replies, and one of those became a client. And then later on, I wanted another property manager because I was getting into, I was seeing the income potential and getting super motivated. So the next time around, I did the same thing. I sent out a bunch of emails, but this time I set my trip fee at $125, and I got two responses, and both of them ended up becoming clients. And then there were some times later where I've sought new property managers just to fill in some gaps, and I've just kept it at the 125. I do feel just in my market locally, I think that's about where they're comfortable. But yeah, that's how I found them. The only thing I recommend differently these days, like on my channel, is I tell people, and I've received word back from my subscribers who have done this, dozens and dozens and dozens of them. What I recommend is you create a little packet that has your business license, your insurance, your workman's comp or your workman's comp waiver, a list of services, a page that shows your pricing structures, all the stuff they need to see that you are a legitimate professional business and that they're not going to need to worry that you're just some guy who's not going to follow through on things. And I recommend personally going to their offices, like just set up 12 of them for one day that you want to go to. You may not hit all 12, but start with number one and just show up in person at each office, drop that packet off, look them in the eyes, shake their hand, make them feel their biggest fear is that the guy they're hiring is not going to be someone that tenants are comfortable having inside their home. So if you show up in person, I think you overcome your biggest obstacle. And then even if they don't need you that day, 3 months from now, their handyman may get, you know, when I started, we were getting, well, what do they call it during COVID? The payments, you just like get $3,000 from the government, the stimulus checks.
Oh, the stimulus, yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I noticed was property managers that I had approached previously who didn't need me, right after stimulus checks would go out, I'd start getting calls from them. And I realized their handymen are not running a business. They're just trying to make money and pay bills. So when they get that $3,000 check, they're just not as interested in working. So even if they don't hire you that day, if they have your information physically in a file somewhere and they've met you and they're comfortable with you, the day that they realize they need a new handyman, I think you're at the top of that list.
Yep. I definitely agree with you. That's something actually we're working on right now is creating some of those folders. Probably a few months ago, I created a whole list of property managers around me, and I went to the actual offices. And one guy that ran one of the property managers that or the agencies that I was stopping at, he like ran up to me and he shook my hand. He was super excited. He's like, man, I can't believe that there's still people out there that do this, like do business face to face. And it just, it really makes an impression on people when you take the time, create the folder that has high quality. And you can create, one thing I'm doing right now is you could create all these really nice looking slip sheets on Canva and, you know, really have something really professional out to these property managers with your W-9, with your insurance. I think that's
all of it. Your LLC incorporation paperwork, everything, every piece of info that they could possibly ask for when you onboard with them. You've just basically given them all of that in advance. So on the day that, you know, somebody's like a handyman's working on a sink and he busts the shutoff valve under the sink and he doesn't know what to do about it and they need somebody right now.
Right.
They can just call you. They've got all your info. They know they're going to be able to get you into the system with your direct deposit information and all of that and just be able to just call you, send you a job. You go get it done. Now you've saved the day and they're going to start looking at you as maybe a better source of work order completion than the guy that they've been using on the side.
Yep.
And they will pay a premium for it. They just will. Because those the I think as handymen, not you and I, but we collectively have a bad reputation. And I believe we've earned that bad reputation. Again, the collective we, if you just look at everyone who identifies as a handyman, most of them are not the type of people that if you're a business who needs a solid business providing a service, most of them are not going to fit that bill.
Mm-hmm.
I love
you can really charge a premium when you can become that for them.
Yeah, I love how you've all laid that out, Ray, as far as the whole presentation, how you show up, how you present yourself, how you actually do the work, how you provide that customer experience. It all leads the ideal client to like understand that you're going to meet their main need, which is send me the work order and forget about it.
And forget about it. This is not your job anymore. I've taken that off of your plate.
And also a good point too is that it might not be that day. It might not be next week, next month, but when that need arises and they are tired of unreliable work, having that packet, you're just clearly saying, hey, when you're ready to not worry about it, I'll be here. You'll pay more, but you're going
And
to
they get
meet their
used to it.
dream.
They get used to it. After you do that for them for a while, they get used to having that easier job. So they're even less likely to want to hire anybody else. Somebody can come along that's 25, $100 trip fee instead of 125, and they're going to go, this is not my money I'm spending. So do I want to save the homeowner that I'm renting this property out for? Do I want to save him $25 and make my job harder? Or do I want to spend that homeowner's $25 on a more reliable service and make my job easier?
So I have a question on like the quality of the client. Because the biggest I know the biggest objection the property manager is similar with realtors is that they want things done super fast and super cheap. I usually my typical response is, well, homeowners are the same way. 10 to 20% of them are maybe your ideal client that will pay a premium rate for a premium service. But I'm curious what you think about property managers. Is that the same, like where there's a top tier that are your ideal clients, or is a bunch of them just being miscommunicated to as far as like that whole matching their need of forget about it? Like, what do you think about that?
So, two answers there. Answer number one is they're just people, just like all other people. Same kind of percentage. 20% of them are ideal customers. 50% of them are bad customers. So if you go acquire three or four property managers and you have a bad experience, it's not because property managers are no good. It's because it's just there's good people and bad people, and the same applies to property managers. So you still go through the vetting process. You still need to fire the bad ones, and you still need to hyper focus on the best ones. The other thing that I'll add to that is property managers, again, like all people, a lot of times people know what they want, but they don't know what they need. And I think a lot of properties, let's say you're a 23-year-old single mom and you get a job at a property management company. Suddenly you're a property manager. You don't know anything about the industry, but the girl who's training you says, here's the handyman's number. This is how we do business. This is about how much we should be paying for these services. She's just been taught whatever was done before she arrived. She doesn't know that there is a different world out there where she has a reliable handyman who costs more money. She thinks that she wants the cheapest service, and she doesn't know what she actually needs is reliability. So sometimes you just have to get your foot in the door and show them what it is that you serve, and they eventually come around and go, oh, okay, yeah, I'm gonna stop fighting the dollar value here, and I'm gonna start just worrying more about the fact that when I send these jobs, they get done, and I never hear complaints. I mean, maybe 4 times a year, a tenant might complain to a property manager about something, but that's a pretty good number, when you're knocking out 1,000 jobs a year. And maybe 4 out of 1,000 jobs feel it necessary to call a property manager. I feel like that many people in the world just like being unhappy anyways. They're going to find a problem whether there is one or not. But
The
they don't know
real
what they need
problem.
until you show them because they've never had it before.
I was just going to say the real problem is with the world is that half of the people are below average.
Exactly. Yep. That's exactly half.
Yeah,
That's
that's
good.
That is a mathematically correct statement there.
Good.
Ray, as far as like if you don't mind kind of walking through like your pricing structure, like are like what kind of jobs are the most common? Are you typically in and out? You got your minimum. If you don't mind kind of walking through a regular day and the typical jobs and how the pricing ties into that.
Yeah, I'll try to make it short because it's a little complex. So there's tiers. We'll start at the bottom with what I just call one-offs. I'm not the only one that calls them that, but when I say one-off, I mean there's one property that's got just one thing to be fixed. It's usually a small thing like a leaky sink or something like that. Quick, easy jobs to do. In that scenario, I operate off my $125 trip fee. So it every leaky sink I've done for the last 3 years, I've charged $125 for it because it's always the same type of fixes. They're all fast, just flat 125. Up from that is the same one-offs, but if it's electrical or plumbing, and by plumbing, I don't mean leaky sinks. By plumbing, I mean at least as complex as changing a shutoff valve or swapping out a garbage disposal or sweating some copper, you know, anything that requires at least a little bit of skill. Those are the same type of job, take the same amount of time, generally speaking, but I'm going to charge a premium of like 165 to 185, maybe even 200 if it's electrical or plumbing that I'm legal to do here in Arizona, but that is still complex enough that that it's not just, you know, it's not something anybody could do. So
Would
those
that be a
approach
tier
200.
two? You mentioned the tiers
I
because
think
I
of it as
we
a tier, yeah. That,
okay.
well, there's more tiers coming as well. So the bottom tier is unskilled one-off jobs. Up from that is I don't have a set price, but 165, maybe all the way up to 200 if it's an electrical or plumbing job that required some skill, and still took, you know, like say 30 minutes or less. Up from that is going to be punch lists. With punch lists, it's the one thing I don't have a system on. I just rely on my experience. So like a three-item punch list, I know I'm going to charge my trip fee for sure. But then depending on what the items on the list are, I'm just going to add from that. And I do have some numbers that I use on my computer for certain jobs to keep them somewhat standardized. But I don't do trip fee plus items. I just kind of look at the overall job and say, I was here for an hour and a half. I knocked out four things. I know other handymen would have taken 4 hours to do that, and they're charging 75 an hour. So I'm at least going to charge 300 for that four item list. But that goes more off feel, and those are more rare. It's almost always a one-off. Up from that is going to be move outs or just all vacant. Sometimes it's onboarding. They're onboarding a vacant property, but a vacant property that needs a lot of work. In that situation, I'm going to charge my $125 trip fee as a standalone line item. So it doesn't cover any work. And then every item after that, I'm going to add a specific value to. And I have all my, like, I use Jobber. I know y'all are on something else, but, and they all kind of have these features where you can create your custom line items so that you don't have to type it in. So I've just got my line items created with a price attached to them. That way, again, if it's a say a big move out, I charge my $125 trip fee. And then if it's a pop-up stopper is a great example, a pop-up stopper in a bathroom. Every time I fix one of those, I'm just going to charge $65. And it doesn't matter if it was a 5 minute fix or if it was a bad one and it took an hour and a half and I had to remove the whole drain assembly. My clients like the uniform pricing. So I'll just go through and click down the list and add all of those. And then anything that doesn't fall under my standardized pricing, I just kind of look at how much time it takes me and try to make sure I'm not going to be charging less than 100 an hour. But it could very easily be far more than that as well. But yeah, the move outs are the trip fee that's standalone, doesn't include any work that gets done. And then each task has its own value after that. And then I guess up from that is estimates. You know, if somebody just wants an estimate for a big job, I just give them an estimate.
So when you do the majority of your work and you have these tiers, do you give the property manager a price up front or do you send them an invoice afterwards because they already know your prices? Or how does that
So
work?
they already know for the one-off jobs that it's going to be $125. Like they know when they send me a leaky sink, they're probably just going to get a bill for $125. But the only time they know in advance what the job is going to cost is if it's something where they've asked me specifically to do an estimate to get it approved first. Everything else, so they have some tiers. This is also common with property management. When they sign with the owner of the home to start representing that owner to rent their property, part of the contract for most of them is going to have an amount set. And it might be 250, it might be 500, it might be 350. I've found 350 is the most common number, where if it's not an emergency, they can just assign the workout and get it done if it's under 350. So my work order, when I receive it, is going to tell me what problem I need to solve. And then it's going to say, do not exceed $350, or provide an estimate if it's going to exceed 350. And then if it's an emergency job, then typically the number is going to be closer to 600. So most of the time, like more than 90% of the work I do, they don't know what I'm going to invoice until I finish the job and send them an invoice. And then what keeps everybody honest is just the fact that, you know, if I can gouge them if I want, you know, for some period of time, I can charge $350 to fix a leaky sink that I should have charged $125 for. But, you know, there are other handymen out there competing with me. I know for sure there's a couple dozen in Tucson that started their business because they were watching my channel, and they've reached out, and I've had lunch with a few of them, and I'll be having lunch with a few more of them. So I'm creating my own competition. And even if I wasn't, that competition is there. So it's my job to really pay attention to the feedback that I get. You know, I want to get complaints about my price sometimes, because if I'm not, that means I'm not charging enough. But if I get too many complaints about my price, then now I'm risking them trying out somebody cheaper than me. And they always seem to come back. But the point is I don't gouge them, and I don't raise my price very much. I do it incrementally over time, and I try to really, truly understand what the fair market value here locally is for my work and just charge that.
That's awesome. And so do you see with this pricing calculation that you have and what you're currently charging with the tiers and all that, is it duplicatable? Like, what's your kind of idea overarching as far as growth? Do you want to grow? Do you think it's scalable, or like, what are your thoughts?
There was a time when I would have said you cannot scale this. You know, 3 years ago, maybe even 2 years ago, I think I would have said you cannot scale this. And to some extent, that's true. There are so many, well, you know this, there are so many complex jobs that require a specialist, that require somebody with real, true knowledge, and you can't scale knowledge. The only way that you can provide that is to hire people with the knowledge. And by default, those people are more valuable, so they're already charging more. It's going to be harder for you to utilize them in your business to scale. However, over time, one of the, you know, once I got into property management, I kind of hit a ceiling for a little bit where it seemed impossible to make more money. And I started really analyzing what I'm doing, and I realized some things. You know, the first big one was I'm going to Home Depot all the time. And what I realized was the value of fixing a leaky sink is $125. That value doesn't change if I go to Home Depot or if I don't go to Home Depot. So if I can start structuring the way I do business in a way that includes inventory, and I did the math, and I'm like, you know, even early on, I was up towards $100 an hour pretty quick. And I was just like, well, it's almost an hour to go to Home Depot. Every time I go to Home Depot, I'm literally it costs me $100 to go to Home Depot, because that's an hour that could have been used to go to the next job and get another $125 trip fee. So, you know, I did the inventory. I started building kits about a year and a half ago, and they weren't super organized kits, but I started putting kits together for types of jobs so that I didn't have to search for my inventory. And then now where I'm at, it's funny that this interview is happening when it is, because I'm grateful my subscribers with YouTube have gotten me financially to a point that I'm able to take some time away from the business at the exact same time that I'm wanting to scale, and at the exact same time that I need my son. My son works for me full time. I need him to step into my boots, and I need it to happen within the next year. And that's not an easy thing to do. There's so much. The only way to know how to do this is by doing it. So he literally needs to do what I did and go through the hardships I went through and learn the lessons I learned. And I'm able right now to have him essentially doing almost every job at every occupied property And then I'm taking the vacants, or I'm taking the really complex ones that he's just isn't ready for. But now I'm putting together bigger, better kits that have the idea being, let's say you have a pop-up stopper, you know, that you need to go fix. You don't need to take your entire handyman van filled to the brim with tools and materials. If you know what jobs you're going to work on that day, you can just grab those kits. Now, currently, I still keep everything in the van, but the long-term goal is to build this into something where I can purchase a vehicle, hire an employee, have, luckily I was in aviation, and in aviation, you don't do anything without a book telling you how to do it, step by step by step. So spending my life in aviation, I know how to write procedures because I've had to help write them, rewrite them, and I've had to use them. So yes, the long-term goal now is to start scaling and expanding out. So these days, I'm spending a lot of my time actually building these kits, writing out procedures, also working and also managing my son and a few other guys who do some work for me. But it is scalable when you know how to do it. And it's not scalable until you've been there and done that, because if all you're going to take is that kit, or if all you're going to take is just what your entire handyman van, if that's the way you're going to do it, you have to know for sure every possible complication that you've ever seen pop up. You have to be able to know what's the maximum amount of time that this job is going to take, at least on 90% of the jobs. And then if 10% of them have a special caveat, you deal with that separately. But you have to have, I think, the actual experience in the field to be able to start scaling it.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things about skill is really in your head. You know, it's having the ability to look at something and figure out how it's supposed to work, and then almost like reverse engineer it in your head.
Yeah.
Because like even just replacing an angle stop can go south real quick.
Yep.
And if you can't think about like, well, how do I address this? Because I've never seen this before. Then, you know, you're going to sink real fast. So that's like one of the biggest things to look for when you're hiring an employee. But I think you hit the nail on the head is the secret to scaling is really creating systems and processes so that people can do things without being you, you know,
like, exactly. Yeah.
One of the key things about that is they have to have that mentality, mm-hmm. especially as a handyman, of like almost like an engineer mindset of how things work and how to, you know, so there is a little bit of like just common know-how. And I don't know I think that's something you're born with, but as you go on, as you make more mistakes, as you have pipes that burst open on you and the house is flooded, like these are things that you're going
to learn. You have to be there and do that.
Yeah. You're going to have to learn it. And unfortunately, that's the only way to do it. But I love the way that you're doing is creating kits and things like that and systems. Like, I love what you said about Home Depot, because that's like one of our biggest killers just a few years ago. Is we had our main technician who was really good at his work, but every time he had to leave the job to go to Home Depot, that was an hour, hour and a half out of his day. And that ultimately costs us, the business, money. So whatever.
And if you're doing three jobs a day, if you go to Home Depot for all three jobs independently, you just spent 3 hours. It cost you a lot of handymen out there who haven't really dove in and started turning their business into a business are excited if they can make $300 in a day. So imagine the significance of losing an additional 300. You could have 300 more than what you're making.
Right. And then the more you do that, then you end up working till 7 or 8 at night. You miss dinner with your family. Like it just, and then you got to get home, and then you have estimates to write, and then you just never get caught up, you know? Yep. So
time is our most valuable resource for any business owner. Anyone who's ever run a business will tell you time is absolutely, without a doubt, your most valuable resource. So you have to learn how to manage it.
You can always make more money, but you can't make more time. I think that's a huge. Sure.
I've got a question for both you guys, because this is a really important topic of basically how do you go to Home Depot less? Because we kind of joke in our like intro, whether you listen to our podcast in the office, on the job, or making your third trip to Home Depot, which it's funny because so many people do it. So my question for both you guys, because I want to hear both, is like, I know, Ray, you already alluded to some strategies you do. How do you reduce the number of trips you make to the hardware supply stores?
Hey, friends, I wanted to interrupt this podcast and let you guys know about something huge that is coming to the handyman industry. I am launching a brand new book that I've been working on for over a year now. It is called The Handyman Freedom Formula. And I want to let you guys know right now, it is available for pre-sale on Amazon. So you can go over and check that out right now. And it will launch fully. It'll be in your hands on Independence Day, July 4th. Perfect time for The Handyman Freedom Formula. This book will be all about the mindset needed to start, grow, and run a handyman business. And it will also help you create a good company culture for when your business grows. So I would highly appreciate you go and pre-order that book right now on Amazon. And let's get back to listening to Ray.
I'll let Alan go first.
Yeah, so this is something that we've tried a lot of different things with. The biggest thing is we started kind of where you were, keeping stuff in stock on the truck. But then what would happen is like you would have all kinds of stuff in stock on the truck, but you'd be missing the bolt that you need. Right? You're missing the one thing that you need. Yeah. So you got to go. Like I always hated those jobs when it's 5:30, you're almost done with the job, but you need one more thing and you just don't have the right one and you got to run Home Depot. So what we've started doing, we've done a combination of things. We keep a lot of stuff in stock on our truck. We love buying kits of things. So you go to Harbor Freight, you get them on Amazon, you get kits of nuts and bolts and screws. And
I agree, they're 100%.
Right? So having tons of kits is helpful. But another thing that we do is we have brought on a technician assistant. So our technician assistant is right now we have a part-time guy. He's actually a junior in high school. So he comes and he works for us after school every day. And we're paying him minimum wage, I think, or maybe a little bit more than minimum wage. And his job is to assist the technician, but also pick up all the material from Home Depot and deliver it to the client's house. So when he's on the clock, if a technician ever needs something from Home Depot, they call him up and they say, hey, Corbin, can you run by Home Depot, pick this up for me? And just by doing that allows the technician to stay wholeheartedly on their job. And they might transition and start doing this ceiling fan because they've done as much on this faucet as they can until they get the part. And then Corbin brings part and they're good to go. So that's how we've addressed it. It's not 100% gravy, right? Because there's always those times when you as the technician have to run and go get stuff. I don't think you'll ever fully avoid that, but setting up as many systems and processes that you can to try and keep that highly paid, highly skilled individual on the job and not taking his valuable time away and having to go to Home Depot has helped us a lot. So that's kind of the long answer of what we've done is we've actually created another position called a technician assistant that, you know, is kind of like a gopher. They're fairly green. They're not as, but it, and it also gives them an opportunity to learn a lot about the construction industry. Yeah. So that's what we've done. What do you do, Ray? I'd love to hear
clarify real quick. To clarify, you're a technician assistant for the listeners out there that might have that role. They drop off the supplies for the job the next day. Isn't that right?
Correct. So, In a perfect world, he would pick up all the materials on Monday for the whole week. And then he would drop it off, drop Tuesdays, drop Wednesdays, drop Thursdays. So the whole week would have materials already at the job. If, you know, depending on how things go, if a job gets sold, you know, the night before, he'll go out and deliver for that job. So yeah, so the whole goal is all the materials or all the materials that we think the technician will need are at the job when he gets there.
Yeah, cool. What I do, so I'll gear my answer more towards the owner operator, handyman, since that's most of the people watching this. And then I'll talk about what I have plans for, but I want people to understand I haven't scaled. So take that advice with a grain of salt. But for me, what I did initially was, for example, garbage disposals. I was changing a garbage disposal every week. So it was very clear and easy for me to say, okay, if I just buy another garbage disposal and keep it with me, and then next time I'm at Home Depot for some other reason, pick up another. If I just always make sure to have one spare, then at least I've saved myself that trip once a week. And I started doing that with every job that I do and just started noticing that, you know, I'm buying the same stuff over and over again. So rather than try to like solve a problem, I tried to just remember that the problem is not really a solvable problem in a big overarching sense, but it's composed of 1,000 little problems that each of them are solvable. So I literally just started really like sincerely paying attention to every time I had to go to Home Depot, I would say to myself, why do you have to go to Home Depot? What could you have done differently? I like to ask myself how I've failed constantly, not in a negative way. There is no error and shortcoming without effort. So the fact that you're doing something and trying to do something that's outside of what you've done means you're going to fail to some extent, and you get back up and you keep pushing forward. So what I did was I started saying, how have I put myself in a position where I'm now going to Home Depot? And if it was because I needed like some very particular trim that I couldn't have predicted, I didn't beat myself up over it. But I would ask myself, could I have foreseen this? Is this something that I buy frequently enough that I should have known to have it? And if it is, then I buy more of it and I put it into inventory, which quickly turned into bins full of stuff, which also isn't useful once you start getting big bins full of stuff. Mm. And then that's where I started building kits. And I could have like, I've got a kit just for light switch plates and outlet covers, just the whole kit. And it's for cable, for phone lines, outlets, and switches, square type and the two-hole type, every combination you can imagine, almond, ultra white, and off-white, every size and shape, one kit, all right there. But it just took a lot of time. All it took was me observing, why am I at Home Depot again? And then actually taking action. And it's the taking action part that matters. It doesn't help to know that you should. You have to actually ask the question, answer the question, and then do something about whatever the answer is. So that's where that's where I'm at now. That's where I've been getting to for the last year. And mine can still improve dramatically. There's so much work always left to do. I scale, though, because the long term business for me is about scaling, probably not until this winter, I'm guessing, like during the slow season. But when I scale, my intent is to have all of my people scheduled. Well, let's say all of my people. Let's start with one employee. To have my one employee scheduled out for the day, to know what their jobs are going to be, to have jobbers set up with these custom line items in such a way that the person who's my office manager will be able to attach to each job what kits are going to be necessary. And what I want to do is not have like a minivan or a bigger van full of everything. I want the employee to know what their three jobs for that day are going to be, show up at work, grab a kit off the shelf, put it on the table, inventory it. Like, it should have an inventory, and the inventory should say exactly what should be in there and what cubby it should be in. Inventory the kit, put it in the car, leave for the day with, you know, maybe six kits, because some of my kits rely on other kits to work as well. Leave with, you know, your six kits, do the jobs, come back to work, put it back on the table, take the new inventory off the shelves, restock the kit, sign the inventory sheet, put the kit back on the shelf. That's my dream. Now, how executable is that? I can tell you from aviation, it's absolutely possible. But even in aviation, where people are used to everything being very much on paper and documented, even then it's a struggle. So that's my dream. Who knows how possible it is?
I love it. It definitely sounds very aviation. You know,
it's very aviation. It's 100. Right. I'm taking everything I learned in aviation and trying to force it to work in probably one of the most chaotic industries in the United States.
You know, but I think that's how you come up with new ideas. You know, we take our past successes and even our past failures and we apply them to our current issues that are going on. So I like that idea.
And it's okay if I fail at it. That's the other point that everybody needs to understand. If you're putting effort in, you're going to fail. Not every time, but you're not going to succeed every time. It's okay to have the idea, have everybody tell you it's a bad idea, believe that it's a good idea, give it a shot, observe when you give it a shot, and if it's not working, change course again. But it's okay to fail. It's okay for your ideas not to work. Move on to the next idea.
Yep. Trying and failing is better than not trying at all. You know, and
I absolutely.
Think for so many people get stuck in, right? Even starting up a business, they're like, oh, I'm afraid I'm going to fail. Failure is part of life.
Yep. And you need to go into it assuming that's a very real possibility.
Right. In fact, the most successful people out there have failed more than anyone else in life.
Yeah.
So the more you fail, actually, the better chance you have of being successful. So,
yeah, because you get to see why you failed and you can correct for that the next time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So one thing, you know, as far as like these tips and these kits go, I love this conversation. So for the summer, I kind of came up with this idea and I presented it to my employee and I said, hey, can you build something like this? And it was cool. He built this kit out of 1/4-inch plywood and it was for sprinklers. So it had like, you know, 1/2-inch MPT by slip. It had all the types of, you know, PVC connectors and it had a place in the back. It was 2 feet long. So you could put a 2-foot section of 3/4-inch PVC pipe back there. And it had everything in there. Like, so you literally just grab that. It has your PVC glue. It has yep. Emery cloth, it has everything. And then each bin is labeled exactly what's in there. So if the technician assistant goes by and looks at that kit and says, oh, we're getting low on emery cloth, I'm going to go get some emery cloth while I'm at Home Depot doing my other stuff. And it's just super helpful because if you're going to do a sprinkler job, you just literally grab that kit, take it.
That's the idea.
Doing it and get going, you know.
That's where I'm trying to take this. And then, like I said, I'm grateful because I have YouTube and the business that it all seems to mesh at the same time where, you know, building the kits and putting together the processes for me, luckily, is also content, because if it wasn't, I wouldn't have that much time to really dive into these kits and to truly analyze, to visualize every job beginning to end, everything that's gone wrong, and build the kit right. You know, and I'm building the kits with tools in them too. So, you know, I'm going to have 37 Phillips screwdrivers because I'm going to have 37 different kits that require a Phillips screwdriver. But then you do away again, you do away with any thinking that needs to be done. You don't need to think now. Now you need to grab the kit. And if you were trained on this job 6 months ago and you haven't even done it since you were trained and you don't remember the training. Oh, also, I'm going to be putting like in my custom line items, I'm going to be putting a link to the video on YouTube that I did and posted for them to rewatch. But the idea would be, even if you don't know what you're doing, if you have the kit and you have the video and or just the written instructions, any 14-year-old high school kid should be able to open up the kit, read the instructions, maybe watch a video and perform these simple tasks, because it's not the work that's hard in the handyman industry. Everybody can learn how to do all of these jobs quickly and efficiently. The hard part's running the business, not doing the work.
Yep. And I can't remember if we've talked about it, Ray, because we've talked a few times before this podcast, sharing some ideas. But did we talk about The E-Myth Revisited? Have you read that book?
Yeah, actually, I had a viewer who recommended that book to me so many times, along with you and other people. But I had one particular viewer who owns a huge construction company and is now breaking into the handyman business. And he emailed me so many times to just like the first time was a list of 12 books, you know, and some other stuff that he thought I should look into that would help. And as the emails kept coming, he kept whittling it down until eventually he was like, look, I just watched your live stream and I really feel like you're at a place in your life right now and in your business and in your growth where it's time, like you're going to read this book someday and you're going to be mad that you didn't read it earlier.
Yeah.
So I did read it. And while I don't agree with everything in the book, the gist of the book is very correct. And I found it to be all of the things that I sort of already knew. You know, sometimes when you don't want to change and you know you need to change and something in the back of your head sort of like clicks in and allows you to just push it to the side and you go, well, you know what? I've got 37 jobs on the books right now. I got to take care of my property managers. I don't have time to put into this. I'll put this time in when I can. And you can do that for 5 years because you just, you know, I love being a handyman. Like I love it. I would prefer to have AC while I do it, but I love heading out and just fixing stuff. I feel so good at the end. If I get 6 or 7 jobs done in a day, which is very doable once you get the experience, I feel so good. I love it. And I don't want to stop holding tools in my hands and fixing things. But I also have to admit to myself that I do have to stop doing that someday. If I don't stop, like, I'm going to die someday. At the very least, I'm going to die. And before I die, I'm going to be incapacitated a handful of times for various reasons. It can't be reliant on me with tools in my hands. But yeah, the E-Myth really helped get me into a mental place where I say, okay, you're right. I need to do it now. This is not a project for later. This is not a project to start on 2 years from now. I've kind of peaked with my skills and my revenue. You know, I can knock out 4 to 7 jobs a day on a consistent basis if I want to work that hard. So there's the ceiling, and I don't like ceilings. So it's just time, you know, to go above that ceiling and start figuring out how to scale this in a bigger way.
Yeah, I love that. And on my channel, I just created, or don't want to give it away, but there's this guy named Bob, right? That he fell off this ladder and he's like incapacitated and he's trying to figure out how to run his handyman business. Side note, it's actually just me like acting like a different guy. Yeah. But like, you know, it's a real thing, right? And what made me think about it is, you know, I'm going to be having a baby here. Well, by the time this comes out, I will hopefully have had the baby. And not me, my wife. And but I'm planning on taking 2 months off, you know? And so there's stuff like this that life happens to you, whether you fall off of a ladder, break your leg, you know, or your wife has a baby, right? And you want to take some time off. You need to take some time off because there's bigger priorities. How are you going to do, you know? Yeah. And I think it's important for people to at least entertain that thought of like, how am I going to do that? And even I had a guy that reached out to me the other day. He's a school teacher and he's been doing the handyman gig part time for about 2 years now. And he's afraid to go full time because he doesn't know if he's going to be able to still have that $2 million left to retire when it comes that time. Right. Because if he sticks with his day job, he'll be able to just keep investing normally, have a cushy job, but he won't be fulfilled. Right. And so he's worried about that. And so we were kind of discussing some options, and I think it's good to have those thoughts and like wonder, what am I going to do when I get old? You know? Yeah. Cause it doesn't last forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, to your point with taking time off for the baby, my twins were, like I said, I quit my job, started this business. And a few weeks later, we found out we're pregnant with twins. So when they were born 9 months later, I was deep in it. You know, I was, this was 16 hours a day. It was my entire life. Not that I didn't have any time for them, but the time I had to be with my family when they were little babies was like nothing, man. You know, I missed out on that. And that was okay. Like I understood that I was trying to build something for my future so that in the future I would have the time with them, especially when they're old enough to really need and appreciate that time more. But yeah, you know, we're going to have another baby. Not right now. We're waiting until we've kind of got our life plans, and I'm sure life will laugh at us, but we've got our plans. We know when we want to have the next one, and I'm going to be in a position when we have the next one to literally take 2 or 3 months off. You know, that's a blessing to be able to do that, because we may not, women are capable of a love that men aren't capable of. The babies need to be with their mother. But the feeling that I get when I get to just hang out with my babies, you know, not just my babies, my 8-year-old and my grown son, too. The feeling that I get when I get to just spend quality time with them and not be scared to death of where the business is at because I've grown it to a certain point. It's priceless. It's just so priceless.
Yeah.
Ray, do you have like another 10 minutes here, man? I know we've kind of went over
all the time you need.
Right on.
I set aside a half a day just in case, because like I said, I like to talk. So I put aside the time in case I talk too much.
Yeah. So I just want to point out too, on the note of saving Home Depot trips, I think that we potentially could be saving people millions of dollars from this episode, maybe. So
totally over time. Yeah.
Super cool. That's why I'm so glad you guys really dove into that. Cause that's a very practical, like our mission here is to teach and inspire, but that's a practical. If we could save guys from doing a trip or two to Home Depot every day, man, that's huge. So
yeah, at the very least, buy a garbage disposal. You Save yourself that $100 a week right there times 52 weeks a year, $5,200 a year just by not going to Home Depot.
Awesome, man. I got another question, bringing it back to property managers. So for the handyman businesses that are largely serving residential clients, but want to serve property managers, they're interested in it. Like, what advice would you have for them to prepare for that different kind of clientele?
I would say what I think is maybe one of the biggest differences that I don't even know how much this matters, but it does matter. I think when you're serving homeowners, a homeowner, they're giving you their own personal money that they worked for and earned. And they have some expectations back from you in such a way that I feel like they look at you more as a person. You know, like they don't just want the job done and done right and done on time. They also want a little bit of you. When you get into property management, that's not a requirement. You know, not that you shouldn't be nice, of course. I mean, I shake the hands of every tenant when I work on their house. I shake their hands. I offer to take my boots off if there's a stack of shoes by the floor and it looks like they don't wear shoes in their house. I try to be extremely friendly. But one of the things to remember is who your client is. Your client is the property manager. Your property manager is representing a homeowner. And all of those people are relying on you to execute the job of fixing a problem. So when you get into property management, although you should, with any business, try to have good customer service for the consumer, just don't forget there's a difference between who the consumer is and who the client is. The client is who pays your bills. The consumer is who consumes the service. So you might be fixing the tenant's toilet, but your client is the property manager and or the homeowner. So your goal is always get these jobs done, get them done right, get them done on time, every single time without any issues. And you should really go into it looking at it as a to-do list. And your job is to knock out this to-do list as fast as possible. So you don't need to take them out to lunch. You don't need to let the tenant doesn't pick the faucet. If the faucet needs to be replaced, you're picking the faucet. They're relying on you to choose the right quality versus price for that home, get the faucet, put it in, and leave. And you don't want to be contacting property managers all day, asking them what kind of, you know, the tenant wants chrome. Should I give them chrome? No, it's just fix the faucet and get out of there. Make a good decision on what you choose, but your job is not to make the tenant happy. Your job is to make the property manager happy without giving the tenant anything legitimate to complain about.
Cool. So you'd say like the biggest difference is because the client is the property manager, just that relational transaction with the homeowner, the property, the tenant, that's the biggest difference there is that relational experience.
I don't know if it's the biggest one, but I think if I made a list of 20 things that you need to know when switching from homeowners to property managers, I think all 20 of those, I could point back to how they stem from the big difference being that the person you're providing the service to in the home is not the person who's paying you. And you have to remember your job is not to make them. I have tenants sometimes who have told me to stop working because I'm putting up a ceiling fan and they don't think the homeowner would want me to put up that ceiling fan. They think the homeowner would want me to put one up that's a little bit different or a little bit closer to the one that used to be there without understanding. I know this property manager. I've worked on this home 15 times in the last 4 years. I know what kind of decisions that homeowner has made in the past when I've said, hey, I can get you something that's almost like kind, but it's a little bit different. Like kind is a word we use a lot. Just means similar in quality and similar in appearance. But I know that homeowner is going to say, no, save me $25 and get this one if that's the only difference. So I make those calls and you have to develop the skill of, again, of doing it in a nice way, but not allowing the tenants to think that your job is to do it the way that they want you to do it. But that's just one of many. Everything, though, will stem from the fact that your client is not your consumer.
That's good. That's really good. So what would you say, Ray, has been some of your biggest wins and your biggest losses in this particular business? You've shared kind of how you've had multiple businesses in the past that have failed, Like, what would you say is some things that you've done right in this business and some things that you've done wrong in this business?
I think I got lucky finding property management so early. My biggest mistake early on, and this is after the food truck and after having learned my lesson about not being special, I entered this. When I started this business, I said, I'm going to build amazing things for rich people up in the foothills. That's who wow. I'm going to be the guy with the portfolio that's charging minimum $1,000 a day. You know, I grew up a carpenter, so I can make beautiful things out of wood. And I really had this idea that I was going to be the special one, even after having failed a food truck for exactly that reason. Once I found property management, I can't really say there have been any big losses. There have been, I've learned lessons, but I haven't learned them by losing. I've learned them by watching the little things that eat away at my efficiency and my profits and fixing those little things one at a time. But sort of in relation to that question, though, my biggest win has been, number one, finding property management. But more importantly, number two, my biggest win has been adopting the mindset of viewing my business as a business separate from me. I don't take things personal. I'm not concerned with how everybody feels. I'm concerned with solving problems for clients who want problems solved. And that attitude of observing myself, looking for my failures, and like, it's not easy to do when you've never... I don't think in the past, any time in my life, I could say I was somebody who looked for where I was failing so that I could tell myself I'm failing and then fix it. Natural reaction of humans is to not want to be the one who's doing things wrong. So therefore, you don't admit to yourself that you are. But my biggest win, I think, was just that shift to where I went from a person working for people trying to make money to a business trying to figure out what my clients want the most and how to give that to them as efficiently and profitably as possible. And then maybe on top of that, my biggest loss was a 2-year time span that I did not get time with my family. You know, like there's suffering is involved in building a business. And yeah. I had the idea that if I pushed hard enough, long enough, fast enough, I would get to where I'm finally at now. And I didn't know if I was right. And luckily I was, but I really broke myself in half mentally and physically for a couple years to get here. And that was a big loss. Like I missed out on a lot that I have to make up for now. But the biggest win is after doing that, now I am in a position where I see I'm with my family when I want to be with my family. I still have Beautiful. To work and I still fill my days 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. I'm being productive. But I get to decide when my family is part of that or when I put that to the side and give time to them and then come back to this. But you have Love to it. Earn it. And the only way to earn it is to just, you got to wake up every day and pound the pavement and suffer a little bit first.
Yep.
Yeah. One thing that I got from you, Ray, when we first talked, probably like maybe even a year ago now, or not quite that, but
it probably was. It doesn't feel like it, but I'll bet you yeah. It was a year ago.
Time flies. But you shared with me the poem or the letter by Theodore Roosevelt about the man in the arena. Right.
I have and that up on my screen just in case I wanted to read it here.
Right. Well, since then, I have a picture of the man in the arena up here. Well, why don't you read it real quick? I think that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, I can have it up that.
Because I think the biggest thing is like if you stay in the arena. Like that's what matters, you know, yeah. And I think that's something that I took away from you is just that, you know, that brute force. So go for it.
I have to bring it back up again. I forgot I closed out all of my tabs because something else was used, but it's going to take literally just 1 second.
Yeah. I got a filler here because you mentioned that new business. I always talk to a lot of new business owners and I describe that phase as the new business hustle where it just takes a lot of work. It takes more time. Stress and it's part of the game and it is about durability, enduring through that time and just plowing through because it is, in my opinion, it's the hardest phase of business is to get to that point where you're able to take care of your families, meet your previous full-time income and exceed that. And it just takes more time and energy than when you're more established.
It does. You have to be willing to sacrifice.
Yep.
Yeah. 100%. Whenever you say yes to something, you have to say no to a few other things. And that's just the way that it works. And
that's right.
Sometimes doing this, you have to say yes to this. And that means you have to say no to some other stuff. But so hopefully down the road, you can say yes to the things that actually matter. Right.
Yep. Because I lost friends because I had no time for them. Some stuck around because they saw what I was doing and they understood what I was doing. But I lost friends. I stopped gardening. I stopped fishing. I stopped camping. Everything that I loved that made me personally happy went to the side. And most of it still is to the side. It's only starting to come back now, but it's worth it. Here's the speech, at least the part of it that I like the most.
What is this? Can you just frame it real quick?
Yeah, so this is a speech by Teddy Roosevelt called, referred to as the man in the arena. And the thing to take from it, once I do read it, the thing to take from it is the idea that if you decide to do this, if you decide to start this business or any business or pursue any big goal in life, you are the one in the arena. All the people outside that arena that are, whether they're criticizing you or cheering you on or whatever, that's all external. You're the one in the arena. And if they're not in the arena, what they think doesn't matter, because you're going to have friends and family are going to tell you that you should just stick to your job because it's stable and you've got health insurance, and they may love you and want you to stay safe. It may be their motivation, but you're the only one in the arena, in your arena. So you have to be willing to give it everything you've got, trust yourself, and understand that just all of the external stuff has to go away while you're in the arena trying to build this. But so here's the actual part of the speech that I go over all the time. I read it on my channel semi-frequently. It says, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat." And it's that last line that gets me, is so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. I'm scared to death of being one of those people. I don't ever want to be a cold and timid soul who doesn't know victory or defeat.
Love it. Love it. I think that that speech encapsulates what you got going on, which is awesome. That's the bulletproof handyman, baby.
There you go.
I love it. Thanks so much for sharing that, Ray. I got a little spine chills when you're reading them. Yeah, I agree. That last portion there really strikes true, I think, to any entrepreneur, business owner out there. And I hope that any of our listeners that are thinking about starting their own handyman business, you'll consider taking up your armor and jumping in the arena. It's a worthwhile endeavor. So wrapping up here, Ray, man, and first off, too, I want to say, like, this has been an awesome conversation. And to our listeners, if you haven't gathered yet, Ray, he does have a YouTube channel called The Bulletproof Handyman. Check him out. Give him a subscribe and thumbs up. Of course, Alan Lee, Handyman Journey. We just really appreciate, Ray, like, all the goodness that you bring to the handyman industry. And it's just a pleasure to have you.
And I feel the same towards y'all. We're doing the same thing.
Yep. And I think at some point, you know, some people could think, like, I know earlier you mentioned creating competition, right? And at some point, it's like a low level is about competition, but high level is about collaboration. And I think that's what we're doing. Like, we both have YouTube channels talking about how to start and run a handyman business, but we do it different ways, and we can help each other with that. We're all trying to grow.
There's a thousand niches in this industry, thousand of them. There's so many ways to do this. There's plenty of room for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
100%.
Love it.
So the parting question, man, is like advice that you would have for a new or prospective handyman business owner. Like, what would you say to this person?
Two things. Number one, which I've kind of already said, but it is, I think, one of the biggest pieces of advice to give is be prepared to suffer and to sacrifice. Yeah. I mean it so wholeheartedly. If your fantasy is to be the guy with the big Ford heavy duty extended cab dually pickup truck with a speedboat and a camper and money in the bank and employees looking up to you and your wife looking up to you, if that's your fantasy, that's fine. But don't spend a lot of time fantasizing that endpoint. Fantasize the way that it feels on a Wednesday when it's 9:30 at night and you worked a 10-hour day and then you invoiced and did admin work for 3 more hours and you finally get up at 9:30 and your wife is on the bed watching TV and the babies are asleep in her arms and you realize they're doing that because of what you did today. So don't fantasize. Wow. Don't waste time fantasizing being the big man on campus. If you're going to fantasize that feeling you get on a daily basis of how you feel at the end of that day when you know that you did everything you needed to do. When you truly, like, down in your core where nobody can tell you anything because you happen to know for a fact that they didn't get up as early as you, they didn't work as hard as you, and they're not pushing half as hard as you're pushing. Fantasize that feeling, and that will lead to someday being the guy with the Ford everything, camper, speedboat, everyone looking up to you and respecting you. It's those daily things that push for however long you have to do it that's going to get you there, not the fantasizing about being there. And then number two, and this is the most important one, it's really number one, do what you say you're going to do every time, not 90% of the time, not 98% of the time. If you say you're going to show up at 9, show up at 9. If you say that it's going to cost $350, that bill better be $350. Every single thing that you, when you're trying to get property managers anyways. Now with homeowners, you lose one homeowner, you lost one homeowner. You've got 50 more. If you don't have 50 more, then you're not busy. So you can lose a homeowner here and there, and it's just a bad Google review and it hurts you a little bit. With property management, or with any business to business where one client is sending you a lot of work, you have to develop the reputation as the person that they literally cannot think of the last time that you said you were going to do something and you didn't do it. Because when it matters, they know they're going to send that job to you. When it's the multi-million dollar mansion that they only want to put the best handyman on, that you can charge the premium on, they're going to send it to you. When it's a rush job, they're going to send it to you. When they need reliability, you need to be the guy who has just literally always, if you say the move out's going to be done by Wednesday, if that means that you're there Thursday morning at 2 o'clock in the morning still trying to make sure before they get into work, they have that invoice waiting. They don't care about your excuses. If you want to be viewed as the most reliable source and be able to charge a premium for it, you have to actually be that. They don't care who you are. They don't care what's going on in your life. You're a business serving another business, and they will keep doing business with you if you are the person who always follows through.
Man, philosopher Ray Duke. Love it.
I think that is 100% why I managed to stumble to where I've stumbled to, is because I just kept doing what I said I was going to do. Mm-hmm. And had I not, they would have found someone to replace me. You know, there's a couple dozen of them in Tucson, I'm sure, that would love for my property managers to start sending them all of my work. And I have taken other handymen's jobs, 100%. I've had property managers who had a handyman. Then I did one or two small jobs for them, and all of the sudden, now I'm doing all of their jobs. So that guy ain't getting work anymore because somebody came around who did what he said he was going to do every single time.
All right, friends, that's a wrap of this episode of the Handyman Success Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us on your journey in building a thriving handyman business. We would love to hear your thoughts on this episode. Whether you learned something new or you're facing challenges that you're just not quite sure how to deal with, we would absolutely love to hear from you. We would love it if you would leave us a review, drop us a comment, or hit that like button telling us that you liked this episode. By doing this, you truly help and support us in creating more of these podcast episodes to help change the handyman industry to something amazing. And I want you to remember that you are not alone on this journey. Jason and I are here to help. If you need anything at all in regards to business or marketing, you can reach out to either Jason or I at handymansuccess.net. You can go over there right now and set up a free consultation call with either of us. We would absolutely love to talk with you. So thanks again for spending this time with us. And until next time, go out and be a blessing.